I'm Bob Boylan with All Songs Considered, and this week, a gigantic Pink Floyd box set is coming out. What's remarkable about Pink Floyd early years, 1965 to 1972, is that it's 27 discs and it only covers the first 7 years of this band. All this week, we'll talk and think Pink with some of the members of Pink Floyd. On Friday, the day this collection's released, we'll talk with drummer Nick Mason about those early years. On Tuesday, we'll talk with Roger Waters. We're going to talk to him about his upcoming project, and politics, of course, enters into that. But I thought we should start with a man who 50 years ago witnessed and participated in those very early years. Joe Boyd was an American working for Elektra Records back in London in 1966, and it was partly his club where Pink Floyd played. Joe Boyd also produced their first single, Arnold Lane. Joe is a critical figure in the British folk music scene and the global music scene, and if you love Nick Drake, then you can thank Joe Boyd for that. His book, White Bicycles, paints some great images of making music in the 60s, including stories of Pink Floyd. He also has a great podcast, by the way, Joe Boyd's A to Z. Joe Boyd is on the line with me. And we start by talking about his days in London in 1966.
I'd managed to land myself briefly a job as the London representative of Elektra Records. And, you know, Elektra in New York felt that my job was to promote Phil Oakes and Paul Butterfield and Judy Collins, and I thought my job was to sign new bands. And I managed to sign the Incredible String Band, and I tried to interest them in this group that I'd heard in Notting Hill Gate at a benefit for the London Free School called Pink Floyd. And Jack Holzman, who owned the label Elektra, he wasn't that impressed. His and my differing views of my role led to me getting fired, basically. And I had to decide whether I was going to stay in Britain or go back to America. And I decided to try and stay. And one of the things that allowed me to, that was sort of central, was my kind of peripheral but nonetheless fascinated relationship with what people were starting to call the underground scene. And it was sort of political. A lot of it was a kind of adjunct of the American scene. The big event that kicked it all off was a poetry Olympics at Albert Hall with Ginsberg and Burroughs and, you know, sort of some of the big guns. Ferlinghetti was there. And, you know, there was a bookshop called Indica, which had the East Village Other and the Berkeley Barb and posters from the Fillmore and stuff like that.
So this is mostly feeling. American art and poetry exactly. Coming to London.
Exactly. And it felt like a kind of outpost.
And who was going to this? Was it teenagers?
I mean, the underground scene was not really teenagers. I mean, what the scene that the Floyd grew out of was a much older crowd. It was a lot of people who traveled, who'd experimented with hallucinogenics, who'd were committed to some kind of anarchist approach to politics.
So we're talking over 30. Is that what you say,
well,
by older?
No, not so much. But also, of course, the other thing about Britain, which always makes it different from America, is that any movement in Britain has to involve fashion. You know, in America, you can be a right-wing redneck and you wear blue jeans in those days. You could be a revolutionary anarchist and you wore blue jeans. In Britain, any movement was expressed in brightly colored fabric and clothing. And there was beginning to be a scene of kind of underground fashion around places like Granny Takes a Trip and Hung
which
on
was,
You.
Which was what, a little shop?
It was a shop which originally started selling used clothes which had been refitted and then started making their own, which were kind of long collars and William Morris prints and, you know, a kind of Aubrey Beardsley aesthetic mixed in with a little bit of acid. In the middle of all of this was a key figure called John Hopkins, known as Hoppy, who was trying to galvanize the underground in a socially useful way. And he started something called the London Free School to open up to poor people in Notting Hill Gate who didn't have access to a lot of information, classes in camera photography and French and how to get money out of the state. And they needed money. And so they would have concerts. And the concerts to raise the money were Pink Floyd. And that was when people first really saw this group that came out of nowhere. And they were very different. I mean, just jumping ahead a little bit, but years later, after Syd Barrett died, after Pink Floyd broke up, Dave Gilmour about 6 or 7 years ago did a tour, and he came to the Albert Hall, and David Bowie came down, and Gilmour said, "Do you want to sing a song?" And he said, "I'll sing a song if I can sing Arnold Lane." And a reporter asked him, "Why did you want to sing Arnold Lane?" And he said, "Because hearing that record and Syd's vocal on that record changed his life."
Arnold Lane had a strange hobby, collecting clothes, moonshine, washing lime. They suit him fine. On the wall hung a toy.
For those who don't, like, didn't get the gist of the song, the song is about a guy who basically steals all sorts of clothing from the clothesline of people and wears them. And you want to expand on
that? Yeah. I mean, it's actually, I discovered years later, I didn't know this at the time, but Nick Mason told me once that Syd Barrett, his father died, and his older sisters moved out. They were older. They went to university. They you know, left home. And his mother started renting rooms. And she found that girls were much more reliable and clean, you know, as lodgers. And so the rooms in his house were often filled with girls from the neighboring college of Cambridge. And in those days, you didn't have any tumble dryers. I mean, you know, people washed their under things and hung them out on the backyard. And girls would sometimes complain, "Wait a minute, I thought I had 6 knickers out there and there's only 5 now." And then there was a story in the local paper about a guy who was convicted of stealing.
Yes.
Yeah, stealing in on women's underwear and things like that. And so this is really a folk song in a way that Syd wrote about his own experience. But the point, I guess, that was so interesting about what Bowie said was that for him, this was the first time that he heard a singer that he liked that was just singing in a kind of simple English way, not trying to sound black, not trying to sound American, not trying to sound super cool, just sounding like himself, singing the way he talked. And this was kind of revolutionary, and this was what Bowie said, that's why it changed his life. And the thing that was so impactful, I think, about the Floyd when they appeared in the autumn of 66 was that they were so English. And that thing that we were talking about a minute ago about how the underground scene in London was very much an adjunct of New York and San Francisco, and it kind of seized its own future at those concerts, those benefit concerts for the London Free School, and became more English. And one of the things that is so interesting about the Floyd is that they started, when they were first formed, they were called the T-Set, and they were a blues band, and they played Jimmy Reed numbers, and Syd was a big Bo Diddley fan.
And their name comes from two American...
It was originally the T-Set, which was a sort of joke about smoking pot, which was called tea in some circles. Mm-hmm. But then when they changed it, those two names of two blues singers were in the liner notes. Paul Oliver, this revered blues historian, wrote these liner notes about Blind Boy Fuller. And in the context, who were some other itinerant singers in South Carolina contemporary with Blind Boy Fuller? Pink Anderson and Floyd Council. And Syd, by that action, he was the one who spotted this. he was getting bored with blues. And he was an art school student, and he was really interested in Rauschenberg, and he was interested in pop art from America, and he'd been exposed to avant-garde music, a group called AMM, which used to turn on the radio in the middle of a set and sort of jam along with whatever came over the shortwave signal. And he was taking this template, which British groups for years had been making successful, which was art school student forms band, interprets American blues and R&B in their own way and creates something new. And Sid really went way off in a different direction. He played with the blues kind of in a very playful and distant way, like just taking these two names, like something stuck on a collage. And it was really a statement of independence from America. And to me, that's why Bowie was so drawn to it. And that's why the group eventually became such a powerful worldwide phenomenon, is because in a way, you know, those chords, Roger Waters' bass lines, are very almost operatic, Wagnerian. You know, they're not just an English version of American R&B. There's something quite European. And so I think that that gave us in the underground scene, and eventually that winter in December, Hoppy and I opened this club called UFO, and Pink Floyd was the resident group. And this became huge, and this was the platform that launched whole swaths of the London population starting to wear different clothes, grow their hair longer, take different drugs, listen to different music, and develop a whole new aesthetic, which flowered in 1967, leading up to, you know, you could say June 67, when the Beatles came out with Sgt. Pepper. You know, that's a kind of simplified narrative of the arc of that period. But the big thing was that it was so European.
I'm going to play a little of this, and then I want you to describe them playing at the UFO, at the UFO Club. UFO Club, yes?
Yeah.
I'm going to take it that these jams went on for quite a long time. This is from the album Piper at the Gates of Dawn. It's Interstellar Overdrive. It came out the summer of 67.
Right. And this was typical of what they would play at the club. And that was a purely instrumental, but there were a song like Arnold Lane or Chapter 24 or, you know, Matilda Mother or any of these songs, they would sing the verse. And they would go off on these long improvisations where, you know, Rick on the keyboard would improvise, Sid would improvise.
But Sid was playing Crazy Slide?
Slide and also they had this echo gadget, you know, which was analog, like a tape loop thing.
The Echoplex, yeah.
The Echoplex. And they would just jam for a long period of time, for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and it would get very abstract. But again, I think that Sid's melodies, this playfully almost folk 19th century type of almost like school kids rhyming songs, you know, very melodic, made those improvisations work. That if it had just been a blues jam, a kind of sub English extension of the Grateful Dead jamming on a blues, it wouldn't have been so interesting or so significant or given the whole scene its confidence. And that song in particular is a classic example of Sid's sort of collage-y approach to making music. It begins when I was trying to interest the group in signing with Elektra. And Elektra and their manager, who was this friend of mine, Peter Jenner, said, "Oh, Elektra, it's a folk label." And I said, no, not anymore. And I gave him Love, The Doors, Butterfield, and Tim Buckley, our new four set of brand new releases. And Jenner listened to them all, and he loved Love. And the first track on the first Love album is My Little Red Book, which is a Burt Bacharach song. And he saw Sid at a rehearsal, and he said, "Sid, I got this record, you gotta hear it. It's got this group called Love, and they're just fantastic, and you'd love it. The opening track is this song, it's called My Little Red Book, and it goes, I just got out my little red book the minute that you say goodbye." And he can't sing any better than I can. And Sid looked at him, got his guitar, and said, "Sing that again." And he sang it again, and Sid went, da 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 da. And that is Interstellar Overdrive.
I'm going to do this.
So it wasn't that Sid wasn't listening to American music or taking things from American music, but he was doing it in such a playful, unserious way and making it very English.
Describe the size of the club, the crowd, what they did, what they drank, what they smoked, what they...
Yeah, the club was... we found a basement club in the middle of the West End, in the center of London. It was an Irish dance hall. And they used to have Irish toe dancing contests, you know, and show bands.
Like which Kaylee is the corniest, bands and stuff.
Yeah, the corniest thing you can imagine. But we said, "Have you got any nights that you don't have a show?" And he said, "Well, we don't usually do anything on Fridays." So we made a deal to rent the club on Friday nights for £15. And the first night, we advertised it in Portobello Road and through leaflets and things like that. And the first night, it was almost full.
How many people are we talking for?
Well, probably not more than 200 people.
Okay, still.
And all these freaks looked around and recognized, and they went, "Wow, there are more of us than we thought." You know, they all thought they were kind of alone.
Beauty of clubs and community, right? I mean, that's the...
Yeah. Right. And we used to start, the whole point, there was a cinema next door that wouldn't allow any PA system to be used before a certain time.
Because it would leak into the film.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So we decided, okay, let's make a virtue of that. So we started at 10:30 at night and went until 6 in the morning when the tube started running again.
Wow.
And there was a tradition in London of all-nighters. You know, they used to have Dixieland all-nighters, Ken Collier Club, and the Flamingo Club, R&B all-nighters. You know, this was not a revolutionary idea. Mm-hmm. And but we would show films, we'd show W.C. Fields shorts, we'd play Indian classical singing between things, we had light shows going on in the corner, people dancing in lights, we had revolutionary literature for sale on a table, we had, sometimes improvisational theater companies would do something in the middle of the audience. Yoko Ono used to come down and do happenings. She came down once and said, "I need a ladder and a pair of scissors and a pickup microphone and an amp."
She put the pickup on the scissors, I take it.
Yeah, that's right. And then we got the ladder out, and she brought this girl, this gorgeous girl, and put her up on top of this stepladder in the middle of the crowd. And we plugged the scissors into an amp. And she then proceeded to cut the dress off the girl with the noise of the scissors, scritch, 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 wow, coming through. And this was before she met Lennon or anything like that. Mm-hmm. She was part of that underground scene. And so it was very fertile and very new and very kind of exciting. And it stayed quite within itself in a way until the end of March, early April, when I produced the first single, Arnold Lane. But then they signed with EMI, and EMI wanted their own in-house producers and their own in-house engineers. But the record came out and was a hit. And all of a sudden, we had people who had heard the record on the radio coming down on Friday night to see the Floyd at UFO. And it was a different crowd. And it kind of, it began to alarm the police, and they started searching people in the line because it was so big. And we had one incident, which I never forgot, which was a police. We said the police would come and say, can we come and have a look around? And Hoppy and I used to say, get a search warrant. You know, we were very stroppy. And finally, this Bobby came and said that he had somebody in the police station that said all of his clothes were on the floor of the club. Huh? And we said, oh, yeah, that makes sense. There was some guy, naked guy, ran out of here about half an hour ago. And there were definitely people taking hallucinogens. I mean, that was part. And there was no alcohol for sale in the club, and nobody minded. So whatever they were doing, it was not alcohol. And the policeman came down, and we all made a big circle and turned on the lights, and he started picking up clothing, articles of clothing from the floor. And of course, he was very nervous and very kind of sweating and looking around anxiously at all these freaks. And then he looked down at his arms, and he realized that he had way more than what was necessary to clothe his one prisoner.
He had other people's clothes.
And he got very embarrassed. Anyway. But it was a wonderful time, pretty much until Sergeant Pepper. And then the whole thing kind of got out of hand.
Because the very underground scene, the very core, was now spread to all scenes.
Yeah, it got swamped. And of course, Sergeant Pepper, you could say, I mean, people talk, there's no smoking gun on this, but it was made in the studio next door to the studio where the Floyd were making Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And McCartney and Lennon had both come down to UFO to see the Floyd. And so I think the Beatles were obviously going in that direction anyway, but I think they certainly were not entirely uninspired by what Sid was up to.
This feels like a cliche, what I'm about to say, but I think it's just sort of undeniable that the influence of drugs and psychedelics in particular fueled creativity to in a certain direction.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's very difficult to measure from our perspective today is exactly what was going on in that period from the early 60s to 68, you know, which was the period of the first spread of hallucinogenic drugs into a certain underworld, is because the drugs were very different than what you get today. When people were taking acid, they were taking pure Sandoz laboratory manufactured acid from Switzerland. Or in America, they're taking Owsley acid, who made a point of absolutely pure drug. And there were very few bad trips, you know, in those days. And then acid started getting cut with all kinds of, you know, when it became a mass market item. And people started, you know, I mean, I knew people who took acid when I was at Harvard in the early 60s, and you would program a stack of LPs, and you would know exactly what food you were going to have and what colors you wanted to see and, you know, who you wanted to be with. And by 68, 69, people wanted to take acid to get hammered. Mm-hmm.
Despite the purity and so forth of the drug that may have fueled creativity, also destroyed the life of Sid Barrett.
Quite possibly, although I must say, you know, I'm somewhat guilty of, I'm not central, but part of the mythology of Sid's collapse. I wrote in the book, White Bicycles, about this moment when Floyd got really big, but they'd always promised they'd come back in the summer and do a date at UFO, even though they could now fill a place 10 times as big for the old price, just out of old friends, you know. And when they came back, they had to come down the main entrance, and they had to squeeze past me to get into this tiny dressing room. Roger and Nick and Rick all came by and said hi, and then Sid came. And I'd always gotten along really well with Sid. And one of the things about Sid that we haven't talked about is that he was so handsome and so charming. And even though they didn't put the, you know, they were in the lights, you couldn't really make out the faces, but girls would really peer through those murky lights to see Sid's face.
And those eyes.
Because he was gorgeous. And he wore eye makeup, you know, and he was sort of androgynous, but not at all gay. He loved girls and was chasing girls all the time. And his eyes sparkled in the dark, in the light show. You could see these dark, sparkling eyes. And he walked past me then this August date or July, end of July, whenever it was.
This is what, 68?
67.
67, I'm sorry.
The UFO only lasted for 9 months.
Did UFO open 66 or this, or,
66,
or December of 67?
December of 66.
Okay, thanks.
And lasted through the end of September 67.
Okay.
And I looked right in Sid's eyes and there was nobody home. The spark had gone out like somebody turned off a switch. Now, I've since, because I've been, there's a big exhibition of Pink Floyd coming up to the Victoria and Albert Museum next year, and they've asked me to write a piece. And I did a lot of research about Sid. And there's a very good book by Rob Chapman called A Very Irregular Head. And he makes quite a good case that the amount of acid damage done to Sid was exaggerated. And that there were long stretches of absolute lucidity and coherence long after that time that Sid walked past me and I said the lights had gone out. And that an awful lot of what he went through in that period from June to the end of the year of 67, when he didn't show up to gigs or he wouldn't play or he would not cooperate, not do interviews, was a genuine rejection of what he was being asked to do as a pop star. That he still thought of it as an art school project.
I see.
And that he didn't really want. And that leads us, in a way, to that song that we talked about, Bike. Because it has a wonderful line. I mean, if you look at the lyrics of some of Sid's songs, they're so simple and so great in so many ways. And the line that I love in that is, "You're the kind of girl that fits in with my world. I'll give you anything, everything, if you want things." He didn't want things. He understood that other people did. But people in his art school talk about how he would do a painting that would win a way high grade from the art master, and he'd just give it away. And he wouldn't care about putting it in a show or anything. And that there also was a history of mental illness in his family. And so I think in some ways the narrative that Sid was an acid casualty and that's what ended his career may be too simple.
I've got a bike, you can ride it if you'd like. It's got a basket, a bell and rings and things to make it look good. I'd give it to you if I could, but I borrowed it.
That's Joe Boyd. You should listen to his podcast. It's called A to Z. Also, his book, White Bicycles, is a great portrait of music back in the 60s and more Pink Floyd stories in there. This week, we're also talking with Roger Waters about all his future projects. Later in the week, Nick Mason, the drummer of Pink Floyd, talks about those early years on Friday. That's the day the box set comes out. And there's more. Come to our site. We'll talk about Pink Floyd all week. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.